Myra Hindley is about to become Britain's most notorious female serial killer. She's been seduced into the world of sadomasochistic sex and violence by her boyfriend Ian Brady. Now he's persuaded her to help him abduct, abuse, and murder children. Brady is in charge of the forensics, count every button, remove stray fibers, recce murder and burial sites. But Hindley gains the trust of their victims.
He couldn't have done it on his own. Never have done it on his own.
Like lamb to the slaughter. Like Brady's always said, they were like lambs to the slaughter.
Five children will die.
I blame her more than I blame Brady.
But others will escape.
I do feel blessed. I was one of them that got away.
David Smith is another. A 17-year-old, the couple debated killing. But instead, they tried to draw him into their vile, sadosexual world.
Brady's mistake was thinking he could embroil Dave into murder.
Instead, David not only becomes one who gets away, he brings the Moore's murders to an end.
Hello, police.
...1960s Manchester, a world of poverty and tens of thousands of slums declared unfit for human habitation. This is where Myra Hindley and Ian Brady met, and where, for a year and a half, they've been sinking deeper into a dark relationship. For Ian, his working-class roots inspire loathing. He's encouraged Myra to feel the same.
Ian Brady often would refer to ordinary people as maggots. Objects to be manipulated less than human.
Those who grew up with Myra saw the difference in her. Liz Cummins lived nearby and was the cousin of Pauline Reed, who became the first Moore's victim.
Myra changed when she started going out with Ian, really. Because even like getting out of the car to go to the betting office next door, I used to shout, "I am Myra," and she'd ignore me.
Sue Carter, who was at school with Myra, used to see the couple in the local pub.
They wanted to be on their own. They didn't want anybody near them. They didn't get up and move, but nobody... They put that feeling out because nobody sat near them, if you know what I mean. Nobody went near them.
Ian had never felt socially at ease and drew Myra to the one place he felt wholly in control, Saddleworth Moor, on the Pennines, east of Gorton. As a child from the slums of Glasgow, it experienced a transforming spiritual connection when taken into the Scottish hills.
This place on the moors where Ian Brady began to feel safe became, if you like, a pseudo-religious setting for him. It had power. He wanted to relate to that power. He didn't need someone else's God. He was creating his own.
He was a predator, and this was his lair. But without Myra, he might never have been able to lure his victims here. On his own, he was a fantasist. He had Hitler's speeches transferred to vinyl, and like him, planned to prove his superiority through the elimination of people he despised.
Yes! Yes!
But without Myra, it was just a dream.
Myra provided that soft face, the female form, the best decoy for actually operating in the real world.
18 months into their relationship, Myra had bought into Ian's idea of murdering children to prove how the couple was separate from and above ordinary society. They'd by now had many trial runs, testing their system for abduction. Myra cruised the streets in her car. Ian followed on a motorbike and would signal three times if he wanted her to stop for a potential victim. It was July the 12th, 1963.
My best friend when I was young was called Marie Rock.
Marie was about to have the narrowest escape of her life.
She used to live next door to Myra's mum, and she was coming from the shops.
What's going on?
What?
Oh, when you pull up?
It's Marie. She virtually lives next door to my mother.
Marie, at the time, was wholly oblivious. We only know what happened through Myra's later confession.
For God's sake.
It's fine. There'll be others.
Untroubled, Marie went on to lead a normal life in Gorton, with no memory of the incident. The next girl picked out that same evening was also a friend and neighbor of Myra's, but she was not so lucky. The story of what happened comes from Myra herself, so should be treated with caution. She told it to journalist Duncan Staff, who was given her unpublished autobiography and papers when she died in 2002.
What you've got to remember is that this was a woman with an agenda. She'd helped carry out 5 murders and she wanted to get out of prison, and everything she said was shaped with that in mind. Myra Hindy's description of the first murder is extraordinarily detailed.
Pauline Reed was 16. Myra claimed she thought there'd be less fuss over a missing teenager. Liz Cummins was Pauline's cousin.
When she seen Pauline, I think it was ideal for her because she was older, and it was easier for her because he would have thought, well, she's took off with a bloke.
Pauline's plan had been to go out for the night with Liz Cummins' future sister-in-law.
Wow, look at you, all dressed up. Where are you off to?
Dance at Openshaw.
No.
Pat Cummins pulled out.
Go on, hop in.
Great.
In fact, Pat Cummins hadn't pulled out. She and a friend were waiting to surprise Pauline, but Pauline never showed up.
They thought that they'd cut across the croft and meet her at the other end and sort of like boo her, you know, say, we're coming with you. The friend said to her, well, she can't have gotten, she just, the flow swallowed her up.
It hadn't yet, but that was a horribly accurate description of Pauline's fate. She was being driven to Ian and Myra's sacred domain on the moor, and one of the most notorious joint ventures in history was about to be sealed in blood. Myra Hindley, a year and a half into her sadomasochistic relationship with Ian Brady, had just persuaded their first victim to get into her car. 16-year-old Pauline Reed was being driven to Saddleworth Moor and her death. Alan Grafton was a childhood friend.
We knew Pauline very, very well indeed. She was a local girl and a local family. Quiet girl was Pauline Reed, very quiet girl. In fact, she wouldn't say boo to a goose.
Myra later insisted it had only been when she pulled over to abduct Pauline that she realised she knew her. But Myra always tried to make herself seem less guilty. Ironically, when Pauline was much younger, Myra had protected her.
There are a number of holes in Myra Hindley's description. She'd known Pauline Reed for years. How would she not recognise her?
Actually, I have an idea.
You
do me a favour?
Myra recounted in detail what happened that evening, including a conversation with Pauline, scripted in advance by her and Ian.
I lost a glove on the moor. Ian will go mad if I don't find it. It's a prezi. Can you give me a hand?
What? Ian was ready and waiting to carry out the supposed search.
So we have a little helper.
Pauline.
Myra claimed she drove off to wait in another lay-by.
So if you just have a wee look for me in this patch over here. She had a white glove. She took it off just in this for me.
According to Myra, during all the killings, she was round the corner, down the road, in another room, never actually present.
I don't think he would have excluded her from the actual sadism and the sadistic pleasure of the killing that he sought. He would want her to share that.
According to Myra, however, she waited 20 minutes, then Ian rapped on the window to summon her to see the body. She said Ian led her to where Pauline was lying with clothing awry, near a spot called Hollin Brown Knoll. She said Ian had told her he was going to strangle her, so she was surprised to find the 16-year-old virtually decapitated. But her account includes a telling detail. She said there were still audible sounds of life from Pauline, who was still bleeding.
Now, the amount of time that somebody bleeds after they've had their throat cut is limited. It has to at least raise the question, was she there when Pauline Reed was killed?
Did you rape her?
Of course I did.
She said she stood as far from the body as possible as Ian fetched the spade to bury Pauline. However, in Ian's later account, Myra was not only present during the killing, but sexually assaulted Pauline and stole her locket.
You hope we need in this?
Myra, who later insisted she'd been an unwilling participant, claimed Ian then threatened her.
If you'd have shown the slightest bit of backing out, you'd have ended up in that grave.
I know.
Back in Gorton, they ran methodically through their pre-planned system for eradicating forensic traces. The car was soaped down, the spade cleaned, clothing cut up and burned, shoes burned, knife burned. As hours passed with no Pauline, her family walked to the dance hall and found she'd never turned up.
They found the place and they waited up all night to see if she'd come home, but she didn't arrive home.
Myra described Ian as being ecstatic the next day. They celebrated, going over the details of the killing again and again. But for Pauline's mother, Joan, and the rest of her family, decades of agony and waiting were just beginning.
It was just devastation. It was just awful. I remember my mum holding Joan. Well, Joan wasn't very... Auntie Joan wasn't very big lady, actually. There was hardly any meat on her, and she was like... My mum had her arm round her, and she was just, what am I going to do? My baby's not come home. Where's she gone? What's happened?
Alan Grafton was a postman and caught the bus at 4:45 each morning. He'd passed Pauline's father, Amos, wandering the streets.
He used to shout, "Morning, Alan." And I used to shout, "Amos, any luck with Pauline?" Because he used to be looking. She was missing. He was looking most mornings, early mornings, before he went to work for his daughter. I just felt so, so sorry for him.
Police and local people mounted a huge search for Pauline.
There was that many media, police and everything in the Gorton area asking questions and trying to find out things.
Among those questioned was the new boyfriend of Myra's sister. David Smith was 15 and would later play a pivotal role in bringing the killers to justice. He lived two doors down from Pauline and they'd briefly been childhood sweethearts. Mary Flaherty Smith is David's widow.
Dave really liked Pauline. She was a neighbour. She was very pretty. They had a nice, young, friendly relationship.
But David came under suspicion because he had a history of violence, including a stabbing when he was 11 and punching a head teacher in the face. Eventually, police decided he wasn't involved in the 16-year-old's disappearance. Myra and Ian returned many times to the moor. They photographed each other by Pauline's grave.
Photographs were tremendously important to Ian Brady because he used these images as a way of recording where victims had been buried. And after the killing of Pauline Reed, they went back and they stood on Hollinbrown Knoll. There's a shot of him standing, smiling, in a chaise and suit, looking cool, and her looking happy as well.
Ian developed the images in his home darkroom.
Looking at them, you'd have no idea that these are in fact grim mementos to their first killing, their first perfect murder.
Myra could have gone to the police at this stage and pleaded she'd been forced into helping with Pauline's murder, but she didn't. She loved Ian and claimed he used this to control her, as she explained years later to her chaplain in jail.
Sometimes he would buy her things, he would take her out, and then suddenly, he would stop all of that and move away from her and not speak to her and ignore her. So when he went back, she welcomed him back.
He went off by himself, saying he needed new experiences, visiting the Rembrandt pub in Manchester, then and now a gay bar. Myra said later that Ian had homosexual relationships at this time. Myra, feeling if Ian could have such adventures, so could she, began an affair with a policeman called Norman Sutton. She told Ian about the relationship.
He said he thought it was absolutely hilarious that she'd been having sex with the policeman whilst they were killing children His reaction to Norman Sutton was entirely different. I met Norman Sutton and he told me how Ian Brady had threatened to kill him.
Ian didn't do that. He did something else, which drew Myra immediately back to him. He said he wanted to commit another murder, like Pauline's. Myra had sex one final time with Norman and told him she'd have to finish with him for Ian.
I just don't know what you're seeing him.
Sorry.
For a time, after acquiring a gun, Ian harked back to his thieving roots in Glasgow and fantasized about committing other crimes.
He imagined himself as a great armed robber going to carry out armed robberies.
They went onto the moor for target practice. But 5 months after the murder of Pauline Reed, he decided the moment had come for another killing. He gave Myra a single, Jean Pitney's 24 Hours from Tulsa.
Dearest, darling, I had to write to say that I won't be home anymore for something.
The lyrics about not coming home anymore were a grim play on the fate of their victim. Giving Myra a record was to become a regular pre-murder ritual. This time, they refined their method. They lined the car boot with polythene to save cleaning. Myra loaded a spade, serrated knife, and a length of cord. She'd bought a black wig. At Ashton-under-Lyne Market, a few miles east of Manchester, a 12-year-old had been running errands to earn a few shillings. John Kilbride was the eldest of four brothers. One of them, Terry, still lives nearby.
We always looked up to John. I mean, he was like our figurehead. My dad was never really the figurehead, because he was either working or he wrote.
John had been given a bag of broken biscuits by a stallholder. What follows is again Myra's account. She said Ian was impatient as they arrived at the market, but she insisted she needed the toilet. She noticed her wig had slipped.
Someone, remember your script, right?
Of course.
Myra said Ian wanted a younger child. Pauline had put up too much of a fight.
Ian and Myra walked up to John Kilbride, said, wasn't it late for a young lad to be out like that? And they'd be worried if he was one of their own. And offered him a lift home.
We was always warned about bad men. You were never warned about bad women. And I think that's the reason why John went to open.
Actually, why don't we stop off where we're picnic this afternoon? Pick up those gloves you lost, eh?
On the moor, Myra again claimed she did not go with Ian and took no part in the killing. She said she drove down the road and waited with a rifle, ready to shoot anyone suspicious who turned up.
You're not telling me anyone at 12-year-old wouldn't be scared. Because he would be. But he was a big lad. He must have put up a fight.
Many years later, Ian told police that after murdering John, he shook his fist at God.
Take that, you bastard!
He said he was then furious with himself for acknowledging God after years of denial. After burying John, he returned to the car carrying John's shoe.
What's this?
Came off when I was raping him. Only noticed it when I was trying to bury him. That was too blunt. So I had to rape him. So I strangled him, didn't I? I'll get in.
Get in!
Back home, they destroyed evidence, including John's shoe. Years later, the other shoe, found with John's body, would be brought to the family to identify him. But for now, their agony was just beginning.
It got 7:30, 8 o'clock, and all neighbours were out searching, everybody was looking round and up and down Ashton, in the lofts, the garden sheds, the coal shed, everything. He'd wrecked me, Dad. I could see what he had done to me, Mum, all the singing and dancing around in the house that she used to do and playing games and everything, just went. And the house was, it was like morgue, it was just dead, completely.
For Ian and Myra, the perfect murder was one that went undetected. They now had two to their name. They revisited the graves and took photos. One of these, where Myra stares down at what proved to be John Kilbride's grave, became a key piece of evidence. On New Year's Eve, 1963, they drove out to the moor. Ian carried a whiskey bottle to John's grave.
It's John!
Myra Hindley wrote to me that she felt she'd crossed a Rubicon with the killing of John Kilbride because John Kilbride was a child. In truth, she'd crossed that Rubicon with the killing of Pauline Reed because there was no turning back once Pauline had been killed. She'd helped Ian Brady to commit the perfect murder, and it was always likely that he was going to want to commit more.
6 months later, Ian declared himself ready for a third killing. In case anything went wrong and their house was searched, Ian had stowed mementos and evidence from their killings in a suitcase and taken it to a left luggage office.
Couldn't get his hand, could you? Gotta carry these heavy boxes from the off license. It's all right, it's gonna help too.
You wouldn't mind giving us a hand looking for something, would you?
No.
Yeah, because we seem to have lost a glove over at Greenfield. Do you want to give us a hand?
Yeah.
Myra describes how Ian led Keith off like a lamb to the slaughter. Myra says that she sat on a bank and waited for Ian to return.
She said Ian was gone for half an hour and told her he'd raped and strangled Keith just as he had John Kilbride. Keith's is the only body never to be found. It's led to decades of torment for his family, including his mother, Winnie, and brother, Alan.
I find it hard to live with the fact that as long as Keith remains on the moor, he's still in the clutches of Brady and Hindley. We'll never know what path Keith would have taken. We do know a good person was taken away by two evil people.
The amount of detail in Myra's account of Keith's murder is far less than for the earlier killings. For her and Ian, murder was becoming routine. But they were about to start making big mistakes. And one 17-year-old would get away, bringing about their downfall. When the Moors' murders came to light, many of those who lived near Myra Hindley and Ian Brady thought about how easily they could also have become one of their victims. Liz Cummins, whose cousin Pauline Reed was the first to be killed, is in no doubt.
They let me go, the little one that got away. There's many opportunities when they could have took me, many opportunities.
She'd often pop through the back door to borrow a shilling for the meter.
One time I'd gone in and Myra came running towards the kitchen because she had to go through to the kitchen, and Ian had his elbows on the back of the couch. And I went, "Are you all right?" Rubbed his head, walked round, and then she was trying to push me out, and I thought that was very unusual because she never used to be like that. And then when I'd got outside, the door locked, and I thought, oh, well, they must be kissing, you know, like, or something like that. But I just wondered it then, was she trying to shield me?
Myra and Ian were increasingly leading a secretive life. But 2 months after Keith Bennett's murder, one figure who would later have a devastating impact on their plans was drawn into their private world. David Smith, boyfriend of Myra's sister Maureen, was now 16. Despite his young age, he already had a criminal record for actual bodily harm.
He was a little bit of a fighter. He was one of the rough lads of the group. So he was on the outside of the group, really, not friends as we were.
David's childhood was troubled. He was brought up by his gran, believing his mum was dead, only to learn she'd abandoned him. David was then taken by his dad to live in squalor.
I think Dave was angry at his dad for taking him away. He would have stood out a bit, obviously, compared to some of the boys. I'm not saying that everybody in them days had a police record. He probably went one level higher and further.
Myra Hindley had never had a good word to say about David Smith. He was very much a rough diamond. someone with great intellectual ability, but also a lot of petty crime surrounding him.
In August 1964, David and Maureen, who were expecting their first child, got married. Neither Myra nor her mother attended the ceremony, but that evening, David and Maureen had a visitor.
Ian would like a drink with you.
David had never paid much attention to Ian, whom he found aloof. But it soon became apparent Ian had an interest in him.
So you got a record.
Ian Brady always viewed the Moore's murders as a discrete set of crimes, an existential exercise. And he'd always, in the back of his mind, had an ambition to be a master criminal, a Svengali, carrying out great robberies. Before the Moore's murders, all of Ian Brady's convictions were for theft. David Smith's convictions were for violence. And this interested Ian Brady because he saw in him a potential soulmate.
In his memoirs, David described how he was impressed by Ian. They discussed crimes they'd committed and things they hated. The couples began spending time together, but there was always a distance. Ian and Myra barely reacted when David and Maureen had a baby daughter. They had other matters on their mind. Firstly, the house Myra shared with her gran had, like 70,000 others, been declared unfit under Manchester's slum clearance programme. They were rehoused in Hattersley, 8 miles closer to the moors. Secondly, Ian decided they should commit another murder, but this time he wanted to take one step further by recording the crime. On Christmas Eve 1964, they sat through the night on the moor discussing a killing on Boxing Day. They'd abduct a girl from a fairground, bring her home, take pornographic photos, and record the whole murder on audio tape. Myra thought the plan risky.
Myra Hindley dealt in detail with all of the killings when she wrote to me, but the one that she dodged was that of Leslie Ann Downey. And the reason she avoided it was because, in her words, she was such a cruel, cruel bastard.
It was also because Myra couldn't twist the truth. The audio tape revealed her presence. When later shown all the evidence, she did give an account to detectives. On Boxing Day, Ian set up and checked his photographic lights and equipment in Myra's bedroom. He shoved under the bed her most expensive present to him, a tape recorder. That evening, Leslie Ann Downey, who was 10, was visiting the fair. Alan West was Leslie Ann's stepfather. Her mother, Anne West, has since died.
She was a daughter that everyone would like to have had. That's the type of girl, Leslie. I think every mother would like to have someone like Leslie Ann.
Leslie Ann had gone to the fair with friends, then stayed on alone.
She's a very shy, quiet type girl. She'd do anything for you. If you want anything from the shop, she'd say, "I'll go and get it," like.
That made her the perfect target for Ian and Myra. They had a new plan for luring their victim through seeking help.
Wouldn't give us a hand, would you? Just need to get these things in the car. Oh, you're good. I'll reward you for this.
With Hindley being a woman, you think, well, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, but that was Leslie. Trust in person. Just trust every time.
Just take it upstairs to Ian.
What happened when they got Leslie Ann to the house in Hattersley was recorded on tape by Ian. Myra told police she went upstairs when she heard Leslie Ann scream as Ian tried to undress her.
I just want to take some photographs, that's all.
On the 13-minute tape, Leslie Ann makes pathetic attempts to get Myra and Ian to be nice to her, calling them Mam and Dad. Myra tells her to shut up or she'll hit her. Leslie Ann's mother, who after the disappearance searched for her at the fairground, would years later have to listen to that tape. She and Alan West had to identify Leslie Ann from her voice and the photos.
Since listening to that tape and look at the photographs of Leslie Ann, I've never slept no more than three and a half, 4 hours at least. I'm up at 3 o'clock in the morning, every morning, because that is my nightmare.
More than any other piece of evidence, the tape which recorded Leslie Ann being sexually abused would seal Myra's fate.
She couldn't distance herself from that killing. Leslie Ann, she clearly was there while the child was being made to suffer terribly before she was killed.
Myra claimed she'd been running a bath to remove fibres from Leslie Ann's body at the time of the murder. But Ian later said Myra strangled Leslie Ann and afterwards played in public with the cord used to kill her. He wrapped Leslie Ann's body and her clothes in a bedsheet and buried her the day after the killing on the moor. Among the communities from which the children had been snatched, fear was spreading.
It all came together on TV, where they were saying that X number of children were missing from the same area. And the police was appealing for residents of them areas to help.
Amidst this, tragedy struck for David and Maureen. On the 25th of April, 1965, their baby of 7 months, Angela Dawn, suddenly died in what would today be called a cot death. Myra arrived with flowers, but Ian stayed outside in the car.
Is Ian not coming?
His coldest and most aloof. But years later, David was convinced that this moment was a turning point.
His baby had just died, and his friend didn't even make eye contact with him. But Dave thought that that was the time that Brady made up his mind and thought to himself, now I can entrap you. Now you're angry. I've got you just where I want you, just at the right time.
Ian once again toyed with the idea of armed robbery. He now took David for target practice on the moor.
For Ian Brady, his campaign of two, him and Myra, was limited. In terms of a sort of pseudo-Nazi militaristic campaign of sadism and terror on others, it was quite limited. Ian Brady had ambitions way beyond that. He needed a commandant. He needed a right-hand man. And David Smith was going to fit that bill.
He began feeding David the same ideas, the same books he'd given Myra. The Marquis de Sade, who preached sexual violence, and The Carpetbaggers, with its themes of rape, incest and paedophilia. He then got David to write essays on what he'd read.
If we spoke about Dave's relationship with Brady, in this day and age, we would talk about grooming. Brady was an older bloke with strange ideas, and Dave used to go along with the ideas because the happier Brady was, then the more beer he bought.
Myra remained deeply distrustful of David.
She may have thought David Smith was going to displace her from Ian's affections.
They frequently visited the moor together. There were occasions which, for David, with hindsight, were chilling. Once, Ian positioned him at a particular spot to admire the view of a reservoir. They were standing on what turned out to be John Kilbride's grave. On another occasion, the two couples went for a picnic, and David lay at the spot they'd chosen. Myra and Ian wound him into some bizarre secret game of their own. It's clear from David's memoirs that when he later discovered this was ground in which children were buried, he found Myra and Ian's overt sexual overturns deeply disturbing. In July 1965, David and Maureen were rehoused to a new flat in Hattersley, near where Ian and Myra now lived. David and Ian spent long, drunken evenings, during which Ian played his Hitler speeches and ranted about Jews and black people.
They're robbing us. They're robbing us. They're on our turf.
It had moved up a notch, and Brady wanted to know what Dave's resolve would be if they ever was to pull off a bank job. Could he actually shoot somebody?
Imagine going to a bank with a gun, right, Dave? Security guy comes up to you. Would you drop him? Would you kill him?
What kind of shoes, blanks?
We're talking murder here, Dave. Are you ready for that?
Ian sent 17-year-old David to stake out a bank on Ashton Old Road and note down all the comings and goings. But when David returned, Ian showed no interest in the notes. David realised Ian had just wanted to see how he'd respond.
Brady was obviously always testing Dave. At every twist and turn was another test.
Look at me.
One night, Ian played Russian roulette with David.
Now look at the gun. You're about to die.
Myra Hindley was deeply alarmed at David Smith entering her and Ian Brady's world. She knew that she would keep quiet. She knew that Ian would keep quiet, but she didn't trust David Smith.
Ian later told a journalist he and Myra discussed killing David. Ian despised what he saw as David's weakness for swiftly making up with Maureen after a row. But Myra objected to the murder for her sister's sake. Within weeks, however, Ian had a change of heart. One night, after a lot of drink, he finally confided to David his and Myra's secret, that they'd killed.
You think I'm lying, don't you?
Ian Brady's confidence at this point was escalating. His narcissistic sense of control over events was actually exceeding his detailed attention to risk.
It's been done. More than once. I've got photographic proof. You've even sat on the grave. Not do another one yet, though. But I will. Soon.
David wrote later that he didn't believe Ian and dismissed the revelations as just another exercise to test his mettle. Within a week, he'd be proved wrong. October 1965. David Smith was embroiled in one of the Brady rituals of killing. Ian had asked him to gather up incriminating evidence. Porn, books including Desaad, and bring them round. It was 3 days since Ian's boast that he'd killed and would do so again. Ian wanted to place all the incriminating evidence in two suitcases, which were to be hidden in left luggage lockers in case anything went wrong.
Don't drop him once it blows all up.
Ian had good reason to speak of the suitcases as a time bomb.
Myra said she had no idea what was in the cases, though of course it was evidence of the murder of Leslie Ann Downey, the evidence that in the end would consign her to a lifetime in prison.
Ian gave Myra the pre-murder single, and its lyrics played on her fears about the involvement of David.
What's wrong with you?
Nothing.
Bye-bye, baby.
The record was It's All Over Now, Baby Blue. Joan Baez sings about a vagabond at the door in the clothes she once wore. That night, David and Maureen had a visitor.
Need you to walk me home. Some of the streetlights aren't working. Do you mind?
An hour earlier, Ian and Myra had driven to Manchester. At Central Station, Ian had selected a victim, a 17-year-old boy.
Edward Evans was an apprentice who'd been to see Manchester United play that day.
All right. Milk. She might do better than that, eh?
Yeah, but the bars are closed.
Oh, I know. But mine isn't. You play your cards or you can go back to mine and my sister's for a wee drink, eh?
Myra arrived at the house with her 17-year-old brother-in-law, David.
Watch the light flick three times.
The later accounts of Myra and David as to what happened next differ markedly. Myra said she was in another room for the violence which follows. David says the opposite. When he knocked, Ian answered and made a remark which appeared to be for the benefit of someone David couldn't see.
Have you come for those miniatures?
Miniature drinks bottles were set out in the kitchen.
Dave! Help him!
David said Ian, watched by Myra, was repeatedly bringing the blunt edge of an axe down on the head of a boy, Edward Evans, who was sprawled against the settee, covered in blood.
Brady's reaction, he was cursing, he was effing, he was blinding. Myra Hindley was very calm, cool, collected, and as though nothing was happening out of the ordinary.
After 14 blows, the boy was still not dead.
Brady eventually started to strangle him with a cord until he absolutely made no more noise.
It was quite apparent Ian expected David to have bought in totally to what had just happened.
That was the merciest one yet. For the way that, how did he take it?
David felt if he so much as flinched, he'd become the next victim. They tied up the body, took it to an upstairs bedroom, cleaned up.
Dave took part in the cleaning up, quite willingly, actually. He always said that he just wanted to get out of that house, whether it be through a window, through the door, even through the roof.
After the cleaning, Ian and Myra suggested tea as though nothing of note had happened. For hours, David had kept his nerve. Finally, he felt it was safe to leave.
Right then, see you both later.
Yes, Dave. You will.
He waited till he was out of sight of the house to run. Only once he was home did his fear get the better of him. Maureen could not take on board what he was saying. They talked and argued through the night, terrified Ian would realise his mistake in trusting David.
Listen, Myra's part of it. They're both part of it. They're both killers.
Finally, at first light, David risked going out to summon help.
Hello, police.
In Hyde Police Station, David told his story over and over to successively senior officers. The following morning, a knock at the door of Myra's house. Police Superintendent Bob Talbot had disguised himself as a bakery delivery man so they'd open up.
Got the wrong house.
I'm a police officer, the man of the house, then.
Bob Talbot came into the house and he asked for the key to the upstairs bedroom where the body of Edward Evans was.
Don't know where it is.
Just give him the key.
Myra and Ian's killing spree was over, but their manipulation would continue from behind bars. Both wrote to their victims' families. We reveal for the first time Myra's lies in a letter to Leslie Ann Downey's parents, and the killers wrote to each other, coded messages to keep their perverted lust alive. But finally, Ian felt betrayed and took vengeance to ensure Myra was imprisoned for the rest of her life.